Animales humanos, animales humanos, animales, animales.
Hello and welcome to Freedom of Species. Freedom of Species is a radio program dedicated to raising awareness about issues concerning animals. Recent podcasts, audio on demand and live streaming available from the 3CR website. All podcasts are available from the Freedom of Species website and you can subscribe to the program via iTunes. I'm Kate Elliott. Today, to celebrate International Women's Day, we are joining 3CR's special broadcast, 24 hours of radio, for women, by women.
I am woman, hear me roar. In numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend.
When Australian singer Helen Reedy released I Am Woman, a song celebrating female empowerment back in 1972, it topped the charts, sold over a million copies, and became an enduring anthem for the women's liberation movement. But some feminists are pushing those iconic lyrics, I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, a little further, to include all females. Breaking down the species barrier and standing in solidarity with their sisters, whether of hoof, claw, feather or flipper. On today's program, we find out why animal rights is a feminist issue, trace back some of the historical links between feminist and animal rights movements, and at the tail end of the program, we are tempted by some feminist and animal rights theory being put into delicious practice.
You can bend, cause it only serves to make me more determined to achieve my final goal. And I come back even stronger, not a novice any longer, cause you deepen the conviction in my soul. Oh yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I pay the price, but look how much I
My name is Nati Guerrero Diaz. I am the co-owner of an animal sanctuary called Big Sky Sanctuary in Strzelecki in Victoria. I am a feminist and an animal advocate and a general ethics enthusiast. I am the convener or one of the conveners of a group called Intersectionality Now, which talks about the intersection of different oppressions, particularly in the animal movement, but in broader movements. And I'm a general loudmouth and somebody who's been talking a lot around the Melbourne scene for a little while. I'm a vegan, and the reason that I became a vegan was very much because of my concern about animal welfare, so not necessarily really knowing at that point the difference between animal welfare and animal rights, but became a vegan because I was very concerned about that. And at the same time, or earlier even, I had the realisation of the need for feminism as being something that we that I should get behind in terms of the, you know, just being able to see the inequalities that women are subject to. And so the two were quite separate interests for a long time for me, and I didn't really make that connection about them being connected or about them being very similar until I started to, I guess, become a little bit more familiar with the idea of intersectionality and the idea that there are all of these different power structures that work towards oppressing people and maintaining the status quo, whereby certain people in society are given privileges over and above others. And so the idea is that these systems of power and oppression manifest differently for different people, but they are all connected. And so the way that you think about it is, say, if you take a woman, they'll obviously have some experience or at least some thoughts about how they might experience sexism in the world. Now, if that if that woman is also a woman of colour, then they'll also have an understanding of how they experience racism in the world. And it isn't enough, I guess, for them or for society to be fighting racism or to be fighting sexism. We need to be fighting both in order to, I guess, address the oppression that's felt by people where these systems of oppression intersect. So that's the idea of intersectionality, that there are lots of different systems of oppression, but they all intersect at some point, and unless we fight them all, we're not really going to get very far.
The idea of intersectionality, that there are shared systems of oppression that underpin all forms of discrimination, was first written about by Kimberly Crenshaw, an Afro-American academic, in 1989, in the field of feminist sociological theory. As in the example that Nati Guerrera-Diaz shared, the argument was based on the realisation that white middle-class women did not accurately represent the broad feminist movement that also included the intersections of race, class, gender, sexuality and disability. However, there's another aspect to intersectionality that is often overlooked, and that is speciesism, discrimination on the basis of species.
So people might wonder what I mean when I talk about speciesism, and that's the idea that it's okay to discriminate or to oppress animals on the basis only of their species. So the idea that because they're not human, they're not entitled to the kind of rights that we would afford other humans, you know, to not be oppressed, to not be the property of somebody else, to not be used as a means to someone else's end, that kind of idea. So in the same way, for example, that in history we've seen women being discriminated against solely on the basis of their sex, you know, also we're now seeing animals discriminated against solely on the basis of their species.
The term speciesism first appeared in a pamphlet written by British writer, psychologist and animal activist Richard Ryder in 1970, describing speciesism as simply a prejudice. Ryder argued in the pamphlet that, since Darwin, scientists have agreed that there is no magical essential difference between humans and other animals, biologically speaking. And he asked, why then do we make an almost total distinction morally? If all organisms are on the one physical continuum, then we should also be on the same moral continuum. The pamphlet was distributed to protest against animal experimentation. However, long before the term speciesism had been coined by Ryder, the fight against animal experimentation, also known as vivisection, had included similar beliefs about the immoral discrimination against animals. And the campaigns attracted people who could relate to the similar feelings of societal oppression, namely women, and specifically feminists fighting for suffrage in Britain in the early 19th century. Dr. Hilda Keane is currently a visiting professor of history at the University of Greenwich in London and attached to the Centre of Australian Public History at the University of Sydney. She has written extensively on the history of animals, including animal rights and the suffrage movement in Britain, and is interested in the relationship between these two movements.
One has to go back a bit into the last decade of the 19th century. In the 1870s, legislation was passed for the first time to regulate vivisection. Now, before that, there was not any particular legislation around vivisection. And there were campaigns to make vivisection illegal. One of the leading lights in this was a woman who was seen as a feminist, Frances Power Cobb. And what happens is, instead of those who are conducting vivisection being treated under the law as criminals who are being cruel to animals, they are exempt. Now, this brought to the fore around the nature of vivisection. Should this be allowed? Should it be regulated? Should it be abolished? And it brought together people from very different views and sort of walks of life. So if you were, for example, religious, you could say that God was in everything, and how could this be done to God's living creatures? If you were very influenced by Darwin, you could say, how could this happen to animals because they're on the same continuum of existence as human beings? And certainly both those who were into Darwin and those who were religious would say humans are both in some way similar to animals, but also different. And one of the differences, they argued at the time, was that then humans could campaign on behalf of animals. There's also a third strand to this, really, which is this idea that if the powers that be, and it was very much seen these are educated people who are acting in this way towards animals. These are not the sort of working class, particularly men, who up until the later 19th century were the main focus of campaigns around animal cruelty, particularly, say, the beating of horses and cattle and so on. These were educated men who, in a sense, as it were, ought to know better. And they were perpetrating cruelty on defenseless animals. And there was this feeling that if such people, and very much thinking about this in a class-ridden society, can get away with doing this on animals, they will get away with doing this on anybody who is vulnerable, which would include children, working-class people generally, and women. So although both men and women were involved in the anti-vivisection campaign, women felt about this particularly strongly because they saw, in some ways, they identified with the animals as being, within the society as they existed at the time, as being sort of helpless, as being, if you like, victims of sort of male power. And therefore, they were seeing animals as animals, but also they identified with them, saying, if the scientists can get away with behaving like this on animals, they can also do this to women.
Hey y'all, this is Natalie from Blue King Brown and you're listening to 3CR. Support community radio and your local music scene. Subscribe now.
I'd like to illustrate this crossover between campaigns for animals and campaigns for the vote for women by talking about a particular meeting. But this was an annual general meeting of the National Canine Defence League, 1910. The leading speaker on this platform is Charlotte Despard. And Charlotte Despard is a socialist. She's a feminist, and she's the president of the Women's Freedom League, which is one of the militant suffrage organizations. And one of the things she says, now this is at a dog's AGM, she says, women have always shown sympathy with such causes. The best of the women are working for them, as are also the best men. The best men and the best women are all the same in one sense. And the best men have a great deal of women in them, and the best women have a great deal of man in them. So she's supposed to be talking about dogs. Then the guy who's chairing the meeting, Harold Bailey Weaver, then sort of thanks Charlotte for speaking, and he says, the sooner you get women's suffrage, the sooner you will succeed in emancipating dogs from cruelty. Now, I think that sums up, if you like, the mood of the time, that there is a real crossover between how people are thinking about the position of animals and how they're thinking about the position of women. And certainly this is reflected at the end of the war when women get the vote for the first time, or some women get the vote for the first time. And at that point, scientists who were in the Research Defence Society, who campaigned vehemently for vivisection. At this point, the scientists said, well, basically, it's a good job that women didn't get the vote before the war, because if that had been the case, then it's likely that vivisection could have been ended. So even the scientists who were against vivisection saw this crossover between women's suffrage and those campaigning for animals.
Although there were many prominent early 19th century feminists fighting both for suffrage and animal rights, one woman's story is the subject of a book by Coral Lansbury titled The Old Brown Dog, Women, Workers and Vivisection in Edwardian England. And it tells the tale of Swedish animal rights campaigner, feminist and humanitarian, Louise Lindaff Hegarby.
What she's very keen on doing is exposing what's happening in laboratories. What Hegarby and her friend Lisa Shartu decided to do in the early years of the 20th century was basically to register as students at University College London, which then was a prestigious university, as it is now, and to see for themselves what was happening in terms of experiments on animals. And it was felt that by personally experiencing methods of vivisection and then publicising it, this would show how barbaric was this treatment of animals. So it was this idea of having to see something for yourself and then expose this. And basically, they attended lectures, they looked at the way animals were being treated, and they particularly looked at the way one dog was being repeatedly experimented on. And this was against the legislation. They also argued that the dog had not had sufficient anaesthetic supplied. And what particularly horrified them was that the medical students were laughing. So it was that the atmosphere was not one of serious sort of engagement with science, but this was a joke. So they went and witnessed this for themselves, but then they wrote about it in what was a notorious publication called The Shambles of Science. The title is quite important because shambles would mean both, you know, messiness of science, but it was also a shambles was the place historically where butchers would slaughter animals. So this has been very provocative. And to cut a long story short, they were basically sued for slander because this was said in a public case and they'd written it down. They lost the case, but basically they won the argument. All their legal costs were paid for by supporters. And as though it was said, no, these students weren't laughing, etc., the people at large, the public, believed Hegarby and Shartu, and they believed that what had happened to this dog was cruel and it should not have happened. So what the women also wanted to do was to see what else they could do around bringing to light this issue. And what we did was very clever initiative, I think, and that was campaigning for, and being successful in this, to erect a statue to the dog that had been killed in this particular way. Now, where they erected the statue was important. It was in the area of Battersea. Now, Battersea nowadays is seen as quite trendy, middle class, etc. At the time, it wasn't. This was a working class area. And it was also an area where Charlotte Despard had worked as a feminist, campaigning for better conditions. There was an anti-vivisection hospital, which would not employ anybody on its staff who conducted experiments on animals. And there was a new radical housing development that had streets with names like Freedom Street and Reform Street. And it was in the middle of this little working class model housing estate that they had erected a statue to the dog who had been killed, the brown dog. And the attitude, as it were, of the dog was sitting there, sort of feet together, very much like the dog on the tucker box in Gundagai, sitting there upright, not cowering, but being, a bold dog. And underneath was this statement that enraged the medical profession, saying, men and women of England, how long shall these things be? And saying that it was in memory of the 232 dogs that were vivisected in the same laboratory in 1902. What then happens, they get the statue erected, it's a radical council, everybody's happy with the statue, except, of course, the medical students and the medical profession. And you have then students demonstrating, it's quite a long way away from there, about three or four miles, students coming there on demonstrations, having little skewers with sort of mock dogs, and attacking the statue. And the statue itself becomes a symbol of the anti-vivisection cause and has to be defended by the police. The local council has to pay for this. Unfortunately, time goes on, and several years later, a right-wing council, this is about 1910, gets elected. And what they do overnight is they pull down the statue and they have it smashed to pieces. So it's not that they just remove it and put it away in a cupboard, but it's a bit like things that say happened in the Soviet Union with destruction of statues of Lenin, or in Iraq of Saddam Hussein, that actually the statue is seen as so important to the cause that it's smashed into pieces. And many, many years later, in the 1980s, a different version of the statue gets erected in a place nearby.
Around the same time of the reinstatement of the brown dog statue in Britain, a French writer, François Edobon, began writing about how feminist concerns were also linked to those of nature and animals due to their shared history of oppression and exploitation by a patriarchal Western society. The term she used to describe this connection was ecofeminism. Laurie Gruen is a professor of philosophy, feminist, gender and sexuality studies and environmental studies at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. She also coordinates Wesleyan Animal Studies.
Ecofeminism has a number of different expressions. There's a variety of different people who have come to ecofeminism through different paths and with different interests. And so some ecofeminists are more interested in thinking about ecofeminism as a way to undo all sorts of structures of oppression and to break down dualisms and binaries, to show that reason and emotion really operate together. So the ecofeminism for some has been based on recognizing the importance conceptually and practically of breaking down fundamental barriers between nature and culture, between male and female, and between the basically dominated and the dominators. So that's one way. Others come through, and I come to ecofeminism, by being both interested in ending the oppression of women and all sorts of other forms of human social oppression and exploitation and domination, as well as the oppression and exploitation and commodification of other animals. So there are some strains or streams of ecofeminism that are concerned not just with the oppression of people and the oppression of or exploitation and domination of nature, but also particularly other animals. The new volume, Ecofeminism, that Carol Adams and I recently edited, that came out just last summer in 2014, we actually trace sort of another way of looking at the roots of this to early anti-violence movements. Anti-violence movements that were concerned about violence against women and violence against children and violence against animals. And so there's a history of linking various forms of oppressive structures, noticing these connections between various forms of oppression and drawing these connections into social justice work. So I think in some sense the very early roots of ecofeminism go way back to worrying about cruelty and anti-violence to women, children, and animals.
One of the most influential modern writers to link animal rights and feminism is American writer Carol Adams, whose pivotal book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, published in 1990, was an in-depth exploration into the parallel oppressions experienced by women and animals. A crucial concept in Carol Adams' work was the idea of the absent referent.
Carol Adams coined the notion of the absent referent as a way of trying to highlight the process of objectification and commodification. So when you talk about pieces of meat, and if that's pieces of literal meat, like a pork chop in the supermarket, or pieces of meat as in women's body parts in, say, a club, what you're doing is you're reducing that individual, in the one case the pig, in the other case the woman, to this part. And that the absent referent, that is the individual, is missing. So instead of the pig, you have a piece of pork or a pork chop, and the reference is absent. And in the same way, if you think of somebody as a piece of ass, a woman as a piece of ass, that's a way of making her absent.
Australian journalist, publisher, and media coach Katrina Fox is acutely aware of how language can be used to exclude, oppress, and diminish another. Katrina writes regularly on social justice issues and recently won a print and online media award from the Animal Protection Institute Voiceless for her article titled Speciesism, The Final Frontier. It was published online by ABC's The Drum. Katrina is also the founder and editor of Vegan Business.
It is all in the language. We don't realise how speciesist our language is, how sexist our language is, how racist our language is. It's so embedded that I even, you know, as an animal rights activist, I sometimes find myself about to go to say something and then I quickly stop myself. We're all brought up in these attitudes. We're not immune to the cultures that we are brought up in. And it really is a case of becoming aware of this and naming it, calling it exactly what it is. You know, we have all these euphemisms for different types of meat. You know, we have euphemisms for so-called humane meat. It's really important, which for me is an oxymoron. It is a case of calling it what it is. So to call it violence, to call it abuse, and sometimes that can be a bit touchy, like people can get a bit upset about that. But I think we do have to name it. It's not a case of making someone else's pain less by making an analogy with animals, which I think sometimes people can be critical of. But at the end of the day, you know, we are abusing animals. We are torturing them. We are killing them. We are inflicting violence on them. And we do have to call that as we see it.
That was The Sexual Politics of Meat by Consolidated from their album Friendly Fascism. You're listening to 3CR's animal advocacy program, Freedom of Species, with a special International Women's Day broadcast exploring the intersectionality between feminism and animal rights. We'll return to the program. This is Laurie Gruen, a professor from Wesleyan University in Connecticut.
One of the things that's so important in thinking about the ways in which oppression functions is that it often works and is sustained by naturalizing the differences between the dominated and the dominator. And what that means is that what we do is we see the other, whatever that other might be, a woman or an animal, as somehow naturally inferior, and we fail to recognize that actually these are socially constructed categories. The category of animal itself is a remarkable category that contains so many diverse individuals, including human individuals, that doesn't even make sense if you think about it in terms of structuring power. So the idea here is that what has to happen in order to understand the way that oppression functions is first to take it away from these naturalizing impulses and recognize that these are things that are constructed, these are systems that are constructed in order to maintain certain relationships of power. And I describe a variety of ways that this can happen, this construction of the other that upholds the oppression of women and the oppression of animals. There's a number of different ways that works. I think one way is through language. We often use language that is diminishing and devaluing for women and for animals. But there's also stories. In some ways, you can think about this as sort of stories that we like to tell about divisions of labor and the stories of women who were the gatherers and who cooked, and the men who were hunters and brought in animal body parts for consumption. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that there were often women who were doing the hunting and men who were doing the gathering. So these are stories that we tell to try to maintain these divisions between women's role and men's role. And I think the same thing is true with animals. We often think that animals aren't able to understand various things. One of the important ideas is that because humans are thought to be rational and animals are thought to be irrational or closer to nature, that there is a distinction to be made. But we really have to ask a question about how often is it that we as humans employ our rationality, and is it really the case that no animal is using their rationality? So these are the kinds of stories that we develop in order to construct these differences. And then ultimately we come to naturalize them. We come to see these differences as it couldn't have been otherwise. And we don't recognize that we can deconstruct these structures and rethink what it is that our relationship with other animals and each other should be.
One of the most naturalized forms of oppression towards animals is the way we use animals in our food production system, particularly female non-human animals. Nati Guerreras-Diaz, co-founder of Big Sky Animal Sanctuary, highlights how the livestock agriculture industry trades on the exploitation of the reproductive systems of farm animals, a form of oppression close to the hearts of many feminists.
Female reproductive systems, in terms of the animal industrial complex, are the one, the thing that the animal production factories, they rely on in order to produce more and more animals. So without, I guess, an exploitation of those female reproductive parts, you couldn't really have production of animals in the way that we have them today. So, for example, if you have a look at milking cows are inseminated, made pregnant, and then they give birth and their young are taken away immediately, so that the milk can then be used for humans. And then once that milking process stops or slows down, or when it's convenient to the farmer, they get inseminated again, and again that baby is taken away and they get milked again for that human milk production. Like, that's very obviously a blatant exploitation of reproduction, which is very biologically a female thing. In another example, hens that produce eggs. Again, they're made to live in horrible conditions, and the egg production is the thing that is exploited. And again, that egg production is something that is biologically very female. And in fact, if those eggs go on to produce male chicks, those chicks are killed. Why? Because those males don't have a purpose, or there's no use for them in that animal production complex. So it's really all these female parts that are being exploited, and female animals are being exploited by reason of their female anatomy and reproductive systems. So I think that should be of concern to feminists generally, because of course there's then an obvious link to the way that female reproduction has been exploited and oppressed. So, you know, that the reproduction of women has been historically something that's, you know, very much at the centre of feminist movement. And the reproduction systems of animals haven't really, I mean, the feminists haven't really answered the question of, well, how do we feel about female animals having their reproductive functions exploited for the purposes of the animal industrial complex? We haven't really crossed that bridge yet. We haven't made those links. I think we need to. Certainly there are some people who are making those links very articulately, but as a movement, we need to start making those links.
3CR, radio that's independent, progressive and making a difference.
Australian journalist Katrina Fox.
So I wrote an article called Why Animal Rights Are Still a Feminist Issue for the Scavenger online magazine. And time that I wrote it, I think there was a feminist conference coming up in Australia, and they were talking about the importance of reproductive rights for human females while serving up the bodies and secretions of non-human females. So I found there's very much a disconnect between mainstream feminism and animal rights. And I think that's a real shame because, you know, when we're calling for our own reproductive rights, how can we do that whilst we're supporting the hijacking and control of the reproductive systems of non-human animals by consuming their products, consuming things like dairy and cheese and eggs? It just seems it's very hypocritical. I think it harms us as women, as feminists, and of course it obviously harms the animals. So I wrote that piece to get the mainstream feminist movement thinking along those lines. I also did a presentation at a Melbourne feminist conference, and it was really interesting. A woman actually came up at the end and she said, "Well, I hadn't even actually thought of those issues." And she was actually turned out to be a long-time campaigner for pro-choice for women, for reproductive rights for women. And she simply hadn't made that connection. And a lot of us don't, because in society, as we know, the way we treat animals, the exploitation of animals is so ingrained and embedded in our culture that often we don't immediately make those connections. So it was really an awareness raising tool. I think we have to constantly, within the animal rights movement, to get other social justice advocates aware of how these animal-based issues, how animal exploitation and violence and abuse is interconnected with other human social justice issues, so that we can all work together to actually make a better world for all beings, humans and animals alike.
Professor Laurie Gruen also believes that the animal rights movement and the feminist movement can learn a lot from working together.
One of the things that I've found interesting and frustrating, and in my current work on entangled empathy, I try to bring this out, but that in the animal rights world, the idea is that what we need to do is break down this othering and break down these distinctions between the human and the non-human, and start to recognize that there's various capacities and ways in which non-human animals are similar to humans, and because of that similarity, we owe other animals a certain kind of sort of ethical response and respect. Now, what's wrong with that picture is it doesn't actually take into account the specific kinds of experiences, the subjectivity of the individual animals. Dingoes are very different than dogs. They're a type of dog, but they have a different kind of experience, and if you put them all into one classification, you're going to miss that experience. And one of the things that feminists have been very theoretically and practically insightful about is how to recognize and value differences. So one of the things that ecofeminists have done is to look at the structures that are central, the philosophical structures that are central in animal rights discourse, and try to recognize and show that there's a replication of a certain kind of individualism and human centrism that parallels a kind of male centrism in thinking about feminism. And similarly, in feminist theory, we tend to think of differences, importantly, you can find and value difference, but feminists have stopped short of recognizing species difference as an important difference to take on board. So what ecofeminism has tried to do, at least the ecofeminism that falls into the category of animal ecofeminism, is to show the ways that you're not going to get animal liberation, an end to animal oppression, by using what you might call the master's tools. And similarly, that feminists, if they're not recognizing the intersectional nature of the oppressions of animals and the rest of the more than human world, are going to miss the opportunity to really get at the core of these oppressive structures.
Nati Guerrero-Diaz.
So there are a lot of theories about intersectionality, and, you know, we can talk all day, but really the strength of it is to put it into practice. And the way that you do that, I think, is to make sure, firstly, that you're aware about what we're talking about, and nobody's going to have all of the answers. These are complex social issues. You don't need to be an expert in every social justice cause in order to just recognise that they're connected and that we need to fight them all, or that we need to at least address them, or at the very, very least, not oppress another group in favour of our own. So one of the things that you could do is when you're doing your animal activism, say you're preparing campaigns or you're doing some animal advocacy, I think it's important to make sure that your advocacy and your work and your campaigns don't rely on the oppression of other groups in order to succeed, at the very least. So, you know, where animal rights campaigns have fallen down in the past, in my view, is when they've relied on things like sexism or classism or racism to send a message about animals. And then taking the next step, that in your campaigning, that you can, you're bringing along other social groups if you can. So if there's room in an animal rights campaign to send a feminist message, then do it. You know, if there's room in an animal campaign to send a message about inclusion of sexual diversity, then you should do that. And similarly, if you're involved in other social justice causes, making sure that the animal question is not just left unanswered, making sure that you, I guess, are vocal and accountable by bringing up the fact that animals matter. I was at a conference earlier this year where somebody said having vegan catering at social justice events isn't just about having vegans be able to eat. It's about making sure that the victims of oppression, the bodies of the victims of our oppression, aren't laid out on the table. And so that's the kind of message I think that we need to start trying to embody when we're working across our social justice group.
Someone who's been putting the theory of intersectionality between feminism and animal rights into practice since the 1970s, in the most delicious way, is Selma Miriam from Connecticut in America.
My name is Selma Miriam, and back in 1977, we opened our restaurant bookstore, Bloodroot, a feminist vegetarian restaurant and bookstore. And let's see, when we started back then, there were about a little under 200 women's bookstores in the United States, that feminist bookstores. And I figured I wanted to start a women's center, and so we were going to do that too, but I wanted to have food because I felt I liked to cook and I felt it was important to have food. And at that time, the other women and I had friends who were animal rights people, and I said, you know, if you're going to do food, it's got to be vegetarian. And I was not vegetarian then, but I thought, well, I think they're right because they talked about the way animals are treated as being parallel to the way women are treated, that, you know, that we're used as objects and animals are used as objects. So I figured, okay, this was a challenge, but I would do that, and I would just cook vegetarian food. It took me a little while to become a vegetarian. I wasn't right away then, but of course now I am, and pretty much vegan, not totally, but pretty much. I guess we have always thought, what would be the feminist thing to do on every issue that we had to deal with, and that's what's guided us from the beginning. So we don't have waitresses, okay? You see, we see it as a political decision that we made. Restaurants have a wait staff, and that's a miserable relationship usually, where, you know, if you drop a fork, you have to call a waitress or a waiter to get you a new fork, or you get seated at a table that, you know, according to someone in the restaurant putting you there, and it's just, it's not comfortable. And the way, what we do is people come into the restaurant, women and men, and they look at the menu on the blackboard and they choose what they want and they tell the woman at the desk, they pay and they take their sip to the counter, and the woman at the counter directs the food that's supposed to be prepared, and then they sit where they like. And it's just more comfortable for everybody. And there's a peer relationship because we put their name on their slip and we call them when their food is ready. So it's not the kind of servant relationship that you have in most restaurants. We don't have chefs. We have cooks. Instead of having, you know, one person who can prepare the food that you pay a high salary to, and, you know, we don't do that. The women who've been with us for any amount of time, we've taught them how to cook really well, and a lot of it they bring their own skills. And so we have cooks. They're not chefs. It's just a different kind of relationship that we're after. It's a self-serve restaurant. We want food that's in season because we're concerned about environmental issues, and we want to eat what local people grow. But the other side to that is we also very much want to learn the foods of other people all over the world. So those are all, for us, feminist issues. A lot of people say, well, that's not feminism. It's, you know, I don't know, humanism or something. But for us, it's feminism because this is how we try to think. We think of feminism as a much broader term than I think most people think of it. There are people who are environmentalists, but they're not feminists. We're environmentalists because we are feminists. It's the feminism that came first. And our concern for the animals came as a result of our feminism. It was something that we could explore that way. And it's wanting to know what poor people eat all over the world, the kind of inventions that women have to do when they don't have lots of money and, you know, they're poor, and how the incredible, wonderful things that they learn how to make, whether it's from corn or rice or, you know, the vegetables that are other places. And that is of enormous interest to us. So we don't do fancy food, but we are serious about having very good food. We want our food not to be at all a problem. We want it to be delicious, so delicious that it's better than anything you can eat in other restaurants that serve meat. And, you know, I think they're very boring, the other restaurants. We do very interesting food. We change our menu all the time, and we have, oh, two very big fat cookbooks. One is about 20% vegan. The other one is 100% vegan. And we're just now working on a third book because every year since we did those cookbooks, we keep getting new ideas. We meet people. They give us recipes. We start studying some other cuisine. And so we come up with new material. You have to love the cooking, you know, and you have to love the people and the customers. And that's what I feel. We're very fortunate because we really like the people who walk in the door. And it becomes almost like the people who come often are our family. We feel very strongly about it. And when we close for vacation, we get homesick. We get homesick for the restaurant. You know, we feel very strongly about this connection between the animals and ourselves. And, you know, it's just that you have to try to do what you can in this life to try to make everything a little bit better, and that's what we're trying to do.
You've been listening to 3CR's animal advocacy show, Freedom of Species, with a special broadcast in celebration of International Women's Day, or should we say International Females Day. Today on the program, we were discussing the intersectionality between animal rights and feminism. If you'd like to listen to the show again or perhaps share it, you can. It will be available on the 3CR website. It is also available on the Freedom of Species website. Also on the Freedom of Species website, we have more information about our fabulous interviewees, including links to Dr. Hilda Keane's blog website. And if you manage to take a visit to London, you would be able to join Hilda on her animal history walking tours. We also have a link to Nadi Guerreras-Diaz's Big Sky Animal Sanctuary. If you're keen on working bees, they'd be keen to hear from you, I'm sure. We also have links to Selma's Bloodroot Restaurant's cookbooks, and Professor Gruen has published many books around the themes of ecofeminism and animal rights. Her most recent book is titled Entangled Empathy and encourages us to focus less on animal rights per se and more on how we ought to work to make our relationships with animals right. Thanks for tuning in this week. You can contact us at info@freedomofspecies.org. We have Twitter, Facebook, and as I mentioned, we do have a website with all the podcasts. Coming up right now, Voice of West Papuan Women, exploring women's role in the West Papuan Liberation Movement. But remember, we have a whole afternoon and evening of women broadcasting about women, but for everyone. So stay with us. We'll go out with a tune that we opened with, the feminist anthem, Helen Reedy's I Am Woman, that seems to just keep on giving. So have a good week and tune in again next Sunday.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend. 'Cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor. No one's ever gonna keep me down again. Whoa, yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I paid the price, but look how much I gained. If I have to, I can do anything. I am strong. It only serves to make me more determined to achieve my final goal. And I come back even stronger, not a novice any longer, 'cause you deepen the conviction in my soul. Oh yes, I am wise, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I pay the price, but look how much I
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.